Next case for argument is United States versus Abir, Mr. Bednar.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My name is Jonas Bednarik. I represent Michael Abir, the appellant in this matter. Mr. Abir raises two issues before this Court. The first issue that Mr. Abir argues is that computation of relevant conduct was made in clear error. And the second issue that Mr. Abir brings forth is that two prior convictions used to enhance his sentence were utilized in violation of his Sixth Amendment rights. With respect to the relevant conduct argument, the gist of appellant's argument is that evidence used to extrapolate historic quantities of cocaine, powder cocaine in this case, were not reliable. A one-sentence, barely audible statement made by the defendant while negotiating with an undercover informant was used to predicate over 90% of the total relevant conduct in this case. The appellant stated to this undercover agent, and I quote, "Last summer, all the way through this little expletive thing, I was doing at least 18 per week." It was this statement, then, that was utilized in the PSR and utilized by the sentencing court.
18 what?
It does not say. In fact, the statement just said 18 per week. The appellant wasn't clear if it was 18 grams, 18 ounces, 18 pounds. He just said all the way.
Well, what did the judge interpret
it? The judge interpreted it as 18 ounces per week. And that then accumulated to 12.2 kilograms of relevant conduct in this case, and of course greatly increased his exposure and his sentence. The reality is that Mr. Abir, the appellant, did not lead any sort of lavish lifestyle whatsoever. The PSR indicated that his liabilities...
Well, that's something for the judge to consider, but why does he have to give a determinative weight? Because, after all, he was arrested with 325 grams of cocaine. How much is that? Isn't that almost a pound?
There's 28.5 ounces in a pound, I suppose. So, or 25.
There's 16
to do the math.
Ounces in a pound.
There's 28.5 grams in an ounce and 16 ounces to the pound. Yeah, I'd have to do the math, and I'm unfortunately a lawyer, not a mathematician, so
well,
I can't do that.
Well, it's about 400. So he had almost half a kilogram.
That sounds about right.
And he was arrested. And that's a substantial quantity.
And indeed, there was a subsequent transaction, which was a kilogram, which was a substantial quantity
right,
as well.
Right.
So
it's not impossible that he dealt 18 ounces. That would be right. So 18 ounces a week.
No, it's not impossible, but what I'm suggesting to this court that it's improbable that he did that. He obviously had motive to inflate and sort of exert his bravado in front of this potential customer because he was inclined to paint himself as a larger dealer such that he may get a subsequent transaction out of this fella. So he had every motivation to act as a bigger player than he was. He had every motivation to sort of paint that image to this individual.
But doesn't the government have every motivation to believe him?
To believe the appellant? I don't think so. Considering the lack of assets, considering the lifestyle he was leading that didn't indicate he was selling these historic quantities, no, I don't believe that it's probable that he did sell those historic quantities. I think it's more probable that this was all, like I say, bravado on the part of the appellant.
So how did he come up with almost a kilogram when he made the sale, the undercover sale, subsequently?
Well, he obviously had access to quantities of powder cocaine and did subsequently provide that kilogram to an undercover agent. But I don't think that fact in and of itself necessarily makes probable the historic quantities that he alleged. Mr. Abir also advances a second argument in this case, and essentially what Mr. Abir is suggesting to this court is that two prior convictions used to increase his criminal history scoring were garnered in violation of his Sixth Amendment rights. Essentially, the argument that he put forth to the trial court and advances in this court as well is that those two prior convictions that both originated out of state court, the state of Wisconsin and Eau Claire County, themselves had deficient plea colloquies with the trial court, and he did not make a knowing, intelligent, and voluntary waiver of counsel. Therefore, he further extends that argument to suggest that the sentencing court in this particular case should not and could not use those prior convictions to enhance his sentence. I provided to the trial court and provided to this court in my briefing sentencing transcripts from both of those prior cases. Like I said, there was two, the first occurring in October of 1996, again in Eau Claire County Circuit Court. The reality is that review of those sentencing transcripts indicates that the appellant was not advised of the maximum and minimum penalties that he faced attendant upon the plea of guilty and upon a sentence. Without that information, I don't believe there's any way that we can make the finding that that was a knowing, intelligent, and voluntary waiver of his right to counsel.
But he had been hadn't he been advised of his actual sentence before he consented to proceed without counsel?
The October 1996 transcript indicates that it was a sentencing after revocation. He was initially sentenced to a term of probation. That probation was revoked. As I indicated to the court, because of the age of that case, Wisconsin doesn't keep, believe it or not, the transcripts that far back. So I don't have available the transcripts from the initial hearing. We do have available the transcripts from the sentencing hearing. And there is indication in there of what the state was asking for and what was happening with that case. That, however, in my opinion, does not satisfy the requirements of Iowa v. Tovar. The U.S. Supreme Court has recently spoken on this issue, and Tovar plainly holds that the Sixth Amendment requires that the accused is informed by the court of the nature of the charges he faces, his right to be counseled regarding any plea, and the range of allowable punishments attendant upon a guilty plea.
I must be missing something, because I thought he was advised of his actual sentence before he consented to proceed without counsel. I mean, he's complaining that the court didn't advise him of his sentencing range, but he actually knew more than his range. He knew what the sentence would be.
I believe that he knew what the state was asking for and what the agreement put forth to the court was to be. The reality is that sentencing judge had the ability
to... Well, what difference does it make?
The difference that it makes is that Tovar requires
this.
Forget
Tovar. What the difference does it make? Was he somehow stampeded into pleading guilty?
In this particular case, maybe not. In the October 96
right,
case...
Right, okay. Now, what about the other one? I mean, that's the concern, right? You don't want a situation in which a person's sentence is enhanced because he was stampeded, bamboozled, deceived, what have you, into pleading guilty and to an offense that he may not have committed or might have been a lesser offense that he committed, something like that. Okay, so did that happen in either of these cases?
It did, Judge, and indeed that's the peril that we...
So explain that.
In the second case, it was a December 1997 case, again originating out of Eau Claire County Circuit Court in Wisconsin. In that case, Mr. Hebert was actually sentenced on two separate counts. He entered guilty pleas to an operating while intoxicated as a third offense, and then also some sort of drug violation. Mr. Hebert had negotiated pro se with the district attorney's office, evidently prior to coming into court. What Mr. Hebert's understanding was that he would receive a sentence of 60 days. And on each count. Now, Mr. Hebert mistakenly thought that those 60 days were to run concurrent. He didn't understand the difference between the term concurrent and consecutive. The judge then handed down sentence and says, Mr. Hebert, you have 120 days to serve. And he steps back and says, wait a minute, I thought that I had 60 days to serve. The judge then had to explain to him that, no, Mr. Hebert, consecutive means 60 plus 60, 120. So in that particular situation, he clearly was sort of taken off guard by what was happening. And clearly counsel would have assisted him in at least understanding.
Assisted him in what? To have a trial?
Or to potentially negotiate a concurrent sentence?
Well, what difference would that make? If they negotiated, if what you're saying is the likeliest outcome, if, you know, all the procedural I's had been dotted and T's crossed, is that they would have negotiated, you know, 90 days, right? Now, how would that affect the enhancement?
We don't know. I mean, it theoretically...
Yeah, well, you're kidding. If he got 90 days instead of 120 days, he wouldn't have gotten this advancement?
We do know in that example. But if he would have gotten 30 days rather than 120 days, it affects the guideline.
How could he get 30 days? He wanted 60 days. I mean, he agreed to 60 days. How could he have gotten 30 days?
Potentially with counsel, we don't know exactly where he would have fallen.
I don't understand. He wanted 60 days. How could he get 30 days?
The point I was trying to make was that the guidelines...
He certainly wasn't panicked into pleading into accepting a 60-day sentence. Maybe not the extra 60 days, but that extra 60 days didn't affect his enhancement.
May I briefly respond?
Sure.
Indeed, it did not affect his enhancement in this case because...
Well, this is harmless, these little procedural glitches. They didn't have any effect.
I personally disagree, Judge. I think that a Sixth Amendment violation isn't harmless, and there are situations...
Why not? Why can't a Sixth Amendment violation be harmless?
Because in this particular situation, we don't know what would have happened.
You do know. You just said the best is, you know, maybe instead of getting the 120 days, he would have gotten something closer to the 60 days that he wanted, and that wouldn't affect the enhancement.
The minimum penalty would actually be 30 days.
He was agreeable to 60 days.
And perhaps if he had counsel, that may not have been the agreement. I'll defer to my colleague to respond and save the rest for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bednar. Mr. Vaudreuil?
Good morning. I'm John Vaudreuil. I represent the United States below and obviously represent the United States today. I think just quickly summarizing the government's view of both issues about demeaning them, it's really whether Michael Hebert means what he says. In each instance, that's really the argument, that when he said it was 18 ounces a week, 18 something, and I'll explain why ounces is reasonable, 18 something for 24 weeks, and when in the other two judicial colloquies, he answered the questions and said, look, let's keep going, I want to go forward. Did he understand? Did he mean those things? And Judge Crabb found that he did mean what he said when he said 18 for 24 weeks, and she found that when he talked to those judges, he knew what he was talking about, and he meant what he said. The United States obviously believes those are correct conclusions. Briefly, first on the drugs, the recorded conversation, which adds to his relevant conduct, was, as Mr. Bednarik said, 18 a week. The judge's reasonable conclusion that it was 18 ounces, we were there buying 4 ounces, the informant was there buying 4 ounces, was paying for 2 ounces that was a debt that had previously been incurred. They weren't buying kilos, they weren't buying grams, so it's reasonable that it was ounces. The real question simply becomes, is it corroborated? And I think the court's questions lead into what I'm about to say. They seized a third of a kilo, a little less than a pound, about 0.7 pounds on December 23rd in the traffic stop. A couple months later, in February, we buy the 4 ounces, and we pay for 2 ounces we previously had. 6 days later, with negotiation in between, he shows up with a kilo for $25,000, and he's arrested when the money is flashed. What we I think also needs to just be noted is that there was information in the PSR from Mr. Anthony that he'd ridden around with Mr. Hebert up in the winter Wisconsin area, up in Sawyer County, the northwest corner of the state. From December of 93 to July of 04, 10 years, and he said, look, I was riding around him. He was probably dealing a couple ounces of powder cocaine a week for all these years. The government, I actually raised that as a challenge of sorts to the PSR, but did not. It was not included as relevant conduct, and I don't, at this point, obviously we aren't appealing. We aren't arguing that it should be, but it's certainly corroboration of a long time dealing in ounce amounts. The argument that was in the brief and in today, you know, where's the $300,000 that he would have had for 12 kilos is, it's a standard argument certainly made to juries, at least in our district where perhaps we prosecute people who don't seem to have all the big toys when they're done, I'm not sure why. But that presumes that there's no cost of goods sold. At $25,000 a kilo, which is what we were paying, which also presumes that the government isn't paying more than you have to, which we usually do, I think, that means he didn't have to pay anything for it. And, of course, it's just as likely, he certainly paid something for it, it's just as likely that he's a middleman and that the source in Racine, I think, or wherever he was coming from, is charging him a lot. He's taking a little bit off for each kilo. There's really
well,
no.
But I mean, didn't you find out from him who his source is?
It didn't really play out that way, Judge. No.
He refused to talk? You would have given him a sentence discount,
right,
wouldn't you?
Right.
He just refused?
That's
oh.
correct. He, as people do periodically, decided, I'll take my time. I don't really have anything to say. We sort of happened into Mr. Hebert and had some information and just did the case and kept going, quite frankly. So I think the standard argument, look, he couldn't have done it because they didn't show all this other stuff, the toys, the cars, the condos, what have you. It was rejected by the district court, and I think correctly so. Clearly, or I think certainly, her decision was not clear error based on those facts. Turning to the second issue, again, I think the same question is posed. Did he understand, and did when he said what he said in those transcripts, did he mean what he said? I think a fair reading of Tovar is simply, when you look at these transcripts and you give them a fair, common sense, not some sort of strained reading, can you determine that Mr. Hebert knew what he was doing and did it with the eyes open? And I think those transcripts clearly establish that. And Judge Crabb had the transcripts, and that was her conclusion. Did he know the nature of the charges? Yes. Did he know he had a right to counsel? Clearly, yes. Did he know the possible punishment? Yes. And it's that third criteria, if you will, from the Tovar holding that I think is really the gist of the argument today. Without belaboring the point, it's exactly, I think it was Judge Rovner's question, he didn't know the maximum and minimum on October 96. He knew exactly what he was going to get. If you look, when you're reviewing this, at pages 3 and 6 of that transcript, this is a very savvy fellow at that hearing. He corrected the judge as to the days of jail credit. I think the judge may have said 130, and he said, no, it's 136. He knew exactly what his jail credit was going to be, which nobody can ever calculate, it seems. The ADA was sitting right there and said, look, let's do 7 months with Huber, the Wisconsin work release. Mr. Abe made it clear, that's what I want. I want work release. Everything else didn't really matter to him. He wanted to be able to get out for one reason or another. And then after this was all kind of settled there with the judge, then he was advised of his right, made sure that he knew he had a right to an attorney, and he waived it. He may not have known the maximum minimum, but he didn't need to know those things because he knew exactly what was going to be imposed. Similarly, in December 97 on the OWI and the marijuana possession, it's even, I think, more clear there. It starts out with the ADA giving the charges on the record and the specific sentences that they've agreed to. The judge then goes through a very, very good list that would of all the rights he's waiving, right to trial and so on. The defendant says, let's go on. And the judge then goes over the nature of the charges. And then the judge says an actual maximum penalty here, the repeater. Then the sentence gets imposed. The only confusion that was discussed, Mr. Benarek was up here, is at the end, the 60 versus 120 days, and the judge goes, look it, were you confused? Yes, I was. Do you want to proceed? Yeah, we're already this far. Let's keep going. Again, I think what the record shows is that both state court judges ensured that he knew what he was doing, he knew what he was getting into. Both records established that he was a savvy fella, he was experienced, he was knowing what he was doing. Maybe a lawyer would have pushed harder with the ADA, but that's not the law. The law is, did he know what he was doing when he did it? And I think your conclusion should be the same as Judge Crabb's, which is he did, and given that, she correctly calculated his criminal history. And we'd ask that the conviction be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cordray. Mr. Bednarek?
Very briefly, Judge. I respectfully disagree with Mr. Vaudry and that Mr. Hebert knew what he was doing. I don't think he did. He was indeed advised of maximum penalties on one of the counts in one of the cases, but he wasn't on any of the other cases. He wasn't aware of the difference between consecutive and concurrent. He wasn't aware of potential driver's licensing problems that the court then sort of had to explain to him. He wasn't exactly aware of how much sentence credit he had in and how much the sentence would practically mean he would spend in jail subsequent to that. Tovar is very clear, and Tovar does not say that this just has to, there has to be an assurance that this waiver is knowing. Tovar says that, that these trial courts need to advise of maximum and minimum penalties in order
why?
To get.
Why? I don't understand. If they specify a penalty, why do they need the range? What does that add?
Because I think it goes to the intelligence component of the knowing, intelligent, and voluntary waiver of his right to counsel. And I understand your position that if the court is saying, look, this is what I'm going to give you, then how can it not be intelligent? The reality is when the court says that to Mr. Hebert in those previous hearings, at least on one occasion, he didn't understand what that meant because the court said 120 and he thought it meant 60. So, thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much to both counsel. And you were appointed.